a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a good weekend. I'm coming down with something. Hopefully it's not going to get any worse than this, and I'll be back behind the microphone tomorrow. But just feeling a little cruddy today. But it was a pretty good weekend. As a matter of fact, it was warm on Saturday. I was able to get out and do some chores, and it was rainy all day Sunday, so I was able to hang out with my youngest daughter for a few hours, and, you know, it's always good to spend some time with the family. So, all right, on to today's program. We're going to be talking with Holly Sullivan from the Connecticut Citizen Defense League here in just a moment or two about a gun control bill introduced not by a state representative or a state senator, but by Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, which, unfortunately, in Connecticut, you know, that puts the thumb on the scales, right? I mean, when the governor of this Democrat-dominated state wants something, chances are his fellow Democrats are going to go along with it. And this is not a minor bill. This is essentially a bill that apes the California law banning the sale of Glocks and Glock clones. Unless design changes are made so that they cannot be, quote, readily converted into full auto machine pistols. And the devil is in the details with this legislation, as you will hear. Let's go ahead and kick off our conversation with Holly Sullivan from the Connecticut Citizen Defense League here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Holly, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we've got a couple of topics, one good, one not great to talk about. So Let's get the bad news out of the way first. What are you dealing with from Governor Ned Lamont this session?
Yeah, so the legislature commenced last Wednesday, and before we were even out of the building, I heard that the governor was putting in another gun control bill again. They had it filed the night of the beginning of session, which is incredibly unfortunate. They, like other states, like California, this is a ban on Glock and Glock style firearms that have the cruciform trigger. And it's definitely going to be an uphill battle this year.
Yeah, I mean, and so what are the specifics here? Is this does this stop the sale of these guns going forward? Do existing owners have anything to worry about at this point?
Well, definitely existing owners do have something to worry about. I mean, there's language in there as far as transport. So who knows? You could take it out of state and you come back in. You want to go shoot a match and you come back with it. You've transported it. You brought it back into the state of Connecticut. There's a lot of language in there that is still very vague. Vague and dangerous, I should say. Yeah. There's a lot of concerning things in there. There's also a lot of concern among current owners of all of these types of firearms, not just Glocks, but anything that has that similar system. And people may not even know that they have something that's made that way. I mean, they might hear about the bill and say, I don't own a Glock, and think that they're okay. The other major concern that's coming up is what happens to the value of these firearms, right? So if there is no longer going to be a market for them, or they can't sell them, or an FFL no longer wants to take them on trade-in, you've just rendered a massive portion of firearms in the state of Connecticut totally invaluable. As far as being able to pass them down, you can't pass them down to your children or your grandchildren. What becomes of them? So definitely tons of issues for law-abiding gun owners here in Connecticut.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's worth pointing out that as dangerous as Governor Lamont thinks these guns are, police are exempt from this bill, right? So they still get to own Glocks.
Of course. Well, I mean, they were, for a long time, Glocks were issued to police officers. So there's a lot of concerns here. And I largely question, like, is this actually an initiative of the governors himself? I feel like our governor focuses a lot on financial issues. I would probably suppose that this largely comes from the Attorney General's office or other organizations that press for these issues. I don't think that our governor is particularly invested in cruciform triggers. I don't think that's his world. but certainly those pressures are coming from somewhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think ultimately they're coming from the gun control lobby, right? Because we saw this starting with lawsuits, the city of Chicago filing lawsuits against Glock, city of Baltimore. Then you saw the legislative push starting in California and now spreading to Connecticut. And you know, and it doesn't stop with the Glocks, by the way. I mean, you know, for years, the gun control lobby has been suggesting that basically every semi-automatic firearm is readily converted to full auto and should be treated de facto as machine guns. Brady has made this argument in multiple lawsuits, you know, where a semi-automatic firearm was used in the commission of a crime. The ATF, obviously, even under, you know, Steve Dettelbach, never took that position. But, you know, if the gun control lobby can get the courts or can they can get anti-gun attorney generals to adopt that position, then this is a way to ban commonly owned firearms. Right. And the Supreme Court has said arms that are in common use for lawful purposes are protected by the Second Amendment. This, to me, is an attempt to challenge that. And they're starting specifically with, you know, one brand of firearms or one type of semi-automatic firearm. But if they're successful here, they're going to expand this and make it even more broad.
I 100% agree with you. I think that this is just one step at banning all semi-automatic firearms. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's certainly what we see in other countries, right? Look at our neighbors to the north. Mm-hmm. If they there's things that we have that we assume we're always going to be able to have. And the harsh reality is we cannot make any such assumptions that we will always be able to have them. Because if you look around, there's folks that have certainly lost that ability. And we have to hold strong on stuff like this. Even if we don't own a Glock or we don't own a Shadow system, we have to still fight it every step of the way.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I mean, we saw this start, you know, with lawsuits in Illinois, Maryland, other jurisdictions, and it shifted to legislation in California, now Connecticut. These ideas don't just stay put in one state, which brings us to our second topic. I think a little bit better topic here, the New England Firearms Advocacy Conference, which is going to take place May the 30th. Yep. And I'm really excited about this, Holly. What can you tell us about this one-day conference?
Yeah, this is going to be really exciting. So this has been near and dear to my heart for a very long time. And I think we've actually chatted about it through the years that there is a need for state Second Amendment groups to network more, talk to each other more, work together more. It doesn't mean that anybody's adopting anybody else's ideology. Nobody's looking to step on anybody else's toes or get involved in each other's matters. But how do we better information share? And I think this conference is going to be a first step in doing that. So I want to preface by saying that this is being sponsored and held by the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. So this is their project. And what I really love about this initiative is that I really feel like CCRKBA has the right culture to really support state 2A groups and allowing to lift them up without asking them to take on their agenda, right? So CCRKBA really has a fantastic culture of being like, how can we support you? How can we support state 2A groups? And this conference is going to be the first of many. So the vision here is that New England will kind of be the first place where this happens, but this will be replicated around the country in other regions. Maybe it'll take place, you know, in the Southwest and then in the South, or you name it. A conference is likely going to come to your area at some point in time. But doing it here in New England, I think sends a very strong message. And I think it's exactly what we were just talking about with 5043. You have to be where the fight is, right? We talk all the time about people saying, well, it's getting too hard in my state. I'm going to move. Everybody wants to move to Florida and people want to move to the freer states. And the harsh reality is that it is coming to you, right? In fact, funny side note, one of the most vocal leaders of the anti-2A initiative here in Connecticut moved to Florida not too long ago. And she is now started a group down there looking to take away Second Amendment rights in the state of Florida. So it definitely does move wherever you are. If you live in a better place than where I live, I guarantee you that there are people leaving my state to come to yours and bring their ideology with them. So getting states together to talk about these issues, what have you already been fighting? What do I need to know? What resources can we share with one another? Let's get our legislators to know each other. Let's get our attorneys to know each other. These are things that we've sorely needed in the Second Amendment community. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited that the Citizens Committee is where this is taking off. So it's going to fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in full disclosure, you know, Holly and I are both board members on the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. So we both have a vested interest in this. But you know, it's interesting because when you talk about that activist in Connecticut who moves down to Florida, you know, there are state level gun control groups. But I think more generally, though, the gun control lobby, I would say, is very top down, right? Yeah. It's the national groups that are sort of directing these local chapters. we obviously have national groups like the CC Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Our Arms, the Second Amendment Foundation, Gunners of America, NRA. But, you know, there's a lot more, I think, a lot more autonomy for state level pro 2A groups like the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, like the Virginia Citizens Defense League. They will work with those national groups, but they're not necessarily taking orders from those groups. Right? Exactly.
Yes, correct.
And so, go ahead.
No, and I say, and I think that vision needs to continue. I think that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. But it does, I think, speak to the importance of being able to get in the room together and to, you know, talk again as you know, equal partners in defending the Second Amendment. What are the struggles you're going through? How have you been able to, you know, see some success? Because again, in New England in particular, we're talking about a lot of states that are, no pun intended, under the gun on a constant basis, right? You know, even Vermont, for so long, we could point to Vermont and say, look, they're the outlier, you know, very few gun laws, low violent crime. Democrats have been making inroads in Vermont in the past few years. So this, I think, is important. I'm glad to see that we are going to hopefully take this message and these events around the country. You know, I live in a state that right now has pretty good gun laws. That's not going to be the case in a few months because Democrats are running roughshod over the Second Amendment. So I hope that we get a Mid-Atlantic conference here before long, too. But May the 30th, and it's not, I should ask, I mean, is this open entirely to people from New England? If I wanted to drive up from Virginia, could I go?
Absolutely. Everyone is welcome. And it's certainly encouraged as well, because we want people to take this information home with them. Absolutely. Go spread the word. Come join us. Tickets are available to anyone. It's open to everybody. And we're looking forward to a really good crowd. But I think obviously you're going to see most folks coming from New England and hearing from speakers that are largely based in New England.
Yeah. So it's the, you know, Connecticut Citizens Defense League, Massachusetts Gun Owners Action League, Gunners of Maine, New Hampshire Firearms Coalition, Rhode Island Second Amendment Coalition, Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs, all involved in this event, the Firearms Advocacy Conference. It's going to be May 30th in Chicopee, Massachusetts. My colleague Tom Knighton wrote about this over the weekend. He said, I love the fact that it's going to be held at Castle of Knights. Just the name itself, just, you know, it's a good place to hold it. And then again, this is one day, right? So, I mean, if you're within driving distance to Chicopee, you don't have to worry about getting a hotel room. You can drive down in the morning, drive back late at night. But if you do want to stay over, obviously there's a, you know, place for you there in town. What do you hope to get out of this conference, Holly?
For me, it's all about the networking. I think that, you know, anybody who's been to national conferences before, I think the most valuable thing that you go home with is that phone number that you can say, wow, I connected with so-and-so and they're dealing with this in that state. And I'm going to give them a call next week and we're going to talk about what I can learn from what they dealt with. I think that that is so tremendously important. I want our members, CCDL members, to get to know GOL members. I mean, New England is, compared to a lot of other states that are very vast, New England is actually very small. It's quite drivable. You know, a state like Rhode Island, you can cross the entire state in an hour. Connecticut, you can cross us in about an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours. I know a lot of other states, you look at states like Montana, that's like not even speaking their language. Here in New England, you can pretty much get everywhere. And part of the reason why Chicopee was a good fit is because of just where the highways align. So folks coming down from Vermont, folks coming in from Maine, up from Connecticut, it really just made geographical sense with an eye on sort of the population density along the coastline. But yeah, I think getting people to come together, and I think that that's really a piece of it, is how can people easily get there? How can people easily take this information home? They can come in from upstate New York. It's not that far. It's very accessible. And I think that's really important, because I want people to come and get to know the other human beings in this fight, because sometimes we feel very siloed, like Connecticut issues are Connecticut's. But the reality is you have neighbors 30 minutes away that are fighting a fight of their own, and you never know, it might be exactly the same. And how can you work together and share information?
Absolutely. So if folks want more information about this event, again, May 30th, Chicopee, Massachusetts at Castle of Knights, you can go to ccrkba.org/FAC, right?
Yes.
All right, Holly, listen, we're going to talk to you about this before May 30th, because I want to remind folks that this is going on. But you can sign up now, right? It's not too early to register.
Yep, it is open. Absolutely. And keep in mind, the speaker list is still coming. So there's going to be new exciting announcements coming between now all the way up through May as more speakers get engaged. We definitely have a great lineup already, but there's more to come for sure.
Excellent. All right, Holly, thank you so much for everything you're doing there in Connecticut and across the country in defense of our Second Amendment rights. And I look forward to doing this again very soon with you.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Kim.
Thanks, Holly. Thanks once again to Holly for joining us on the program. We'll be having her back probably about a month from now, talking more about the Firearms Conference there in Chicopee, Massachusetts. If the legislation starts moving in Connecticut, we'll obviously have her back on before a month goes by as well. And again, you know, I mean, the prospects, I have to be realistic. The prospects of being able to kill this bill outright in Connecticut, I don't know how good they are. Any more than, I don't know how good the odds are of being able to kill the semi-auto ban in Virginia. I feel a little bit more optimistic about the possibility to derail a New Mexico semi-auto ban. That's up for a House hearing. In fact, his last House hearing before hitting the House floor later today. Fingers crossed that maybe we can get that bill defeated. But, you know, this is something that we're seeing in state after state. Democrats are marching in lockstep. Even at a time, supposedly, when, you know, more liberals and progressives are becoming gun owners, embracing the segment rights, it has had zero impact, as far as I can tell, on Democrat lawmakers and their support for gun control. So in a state like Connecticut, I don't want to say the fix is in, but, you know, this may be a matter of how much less bad can this bill become rather than being able to defeat it outright. But we'll definitely be following along here and report the latest details to you. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. This is a disturbing one. And again, I just mentioned New Mexico. You know, the Democrats are once again going after, you know, peaceable gun owners, trying to put FFLs out of business by putting a host of new restrictions in place. And meanwhile, despite talk about wanting to get tough on violent criminals, they're not getting tough on violent criminals. And so you've got this story. Flora Vista, New Mexico man charged in infant son's death has history of violence. Sheriff calls it another example of New Mexico's failed criminal justice system. I don't know about you. I cover violent crime stories every day. And most of the time, no matter how disturbing these stories are, I can at least approach it with some level of objectivity. When it's crimes involving a child, and when it's a parent accused of abusing their child, I find it very difficult to remain objective, because I have very strong feelings about these individuals. 43-year-old John Hannon charged last Wednesday with first-degree felony child abuse resulting in death and second-degree tampering with evidence. He is accused of killing his 11-month-old son, whose partially buried body was found in a ditch 2 days after he was reported missing. John Teague Hannon went missing February 7th from a home in Flora Vista while in his father's care. And as the Durango, Colorado Herald reports, Hannon's criminal history shows a pattern of escalating violence. He faced multiple domestic-related criminal charges in 2024, for which he received 84 days in jail. He was discharged from probation, quote, unsatisfactorily. I didn't even know there was a thing that you could apparently not abide by the terms of your probation and yet conclude your probation. But I guess in New Mexico, you can. Child's mom filed for domestic violence order of protection for herself and her children. It was ultimately denied for some reason. Jake Thompson, spokesman for the New Mexico Children, Youth, and Families Department, confirmed that his agency, quote, had a history of involvement with his family. San Juan County Sheriff Shane Ferrari told the Tri-City Record as he drove to Santa Fe to testify before the legislature on crime-related bills, quote, this is another example of New Mexico's failed criminal justice system. The child's mom contacted police, on the evening of February 8th from a home in Flora Vista, telling authorities that her child was missing. And she said she was afraid that something bad had happened to her son because the day before, Hannon took the child on a walk and then claimed that he left the boy in the care of a grandparent who lives in Colorado. The child's mom, Crystal Phillips, asked Hannon to call his mother so that she could confirm she had her son, but he refused to do so. While investigating, deputies said in an affidavit that they learned on February the 7th, Hannon had walked through her property while pushing a stroller. The stroller was found in a ditch. They continued to search the area, and on February 9th, they found the 11-month-old head and left arm buried in the dirt. His torso and legs were visible. Hannon's shoe prints found in the same location. Doctor who examined the tiny little body told sheriff's detectives that the child suffered a skull fracture and an abrasion on his forehead before death. Affidavit says that this little boy was likely alive when his father buried his face in the dirt. According to the affidavit, Hannon reportedly admitted to burying the child, saying, "I knew he was dead." Further questioning led Hannon at one point to allegedly say he made a mistake. Quote, "At one point in time, I did love my kids," and then admitting that he changed. Sheriff Ferrari, in a statement, said there is no greater evil than individuals who hurt and kill children, and said, "You have my word that we will do everything in our power to bring justice to this precious child." And, you know, the sheriff says that this is an incident of New Mexico's soft on crime policies, another failure of the criminal justice system, right? So in 2024, he was first charged with domestic abuse. He was charged with child abuse on September 4th, 2024, for allegedly striking Phillips' 15-year-old son in the face with a closed fist. He also was accused of pushing Phillips. He ended up taking a no-contest plea to battery a week later, was sentenced to 181 days of probation. 4 days after that, 4 days after he takes the guilty plea, or the no-contest plea, excuse me, and is sentenced to probation, police in Farmington, New Mexico, responded to another call at Hannon's home, where he reportedly possessed drug paraphernalia. They were called back 3 days later on September 18th for reports of, quote, yelling and cussing from the home. At that point, he was charged with false imprisonment, resisting arrest, concealing his identity, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Now, all of that would have violated the terms of his probation. But he pleaded guilty on October the 9th, so again, just a few weeks later. Prosecutors very quick to offer him a plea deal. And October the 9th, he pleads guilty to charges of resisting arrest and possession of drug paraphernalia. And he's sentenced to 364 days of probation. 6 days after that, now he's on probation again for two different crimes, including a crime of violence. 6 days later, October 15th, they're called to his home in response to another alleged domestic violence incident. They came back 3 days after that, October 18th, for another domestic violence incident in which one of Phillips' children told officers that his mother's head was slammed into a baby crib. He was charged with aggravated battery, but that charge was dismissed, according to court records. Same day, Phillips applies for a petition for order of protection against Hannah for herself and her children, stating that Hannah had choked her. That order was dismissed October 29th because Phillips did not appear in court. You wonder if that was because Hannon had perhaps threatened her, if she felt intimidated. Hannon ultimately spent 84 days in jail as a result of violating his probation as a result of these charges. But he received an unsatisfactory discharge from probation. And remember, he had been sentenced to 364 days of probation in October of 2024. January 27th, 2025, 2 months after he's sentenced to a year's probation, right after he gets out of jail for violating the terms of that probation, he receives an unsatisfactory discharge from probation. After his attorney, Evan Ferguson, argued that Hannon, quote, had a desire to be present in his family's lives. I mean, I don't know why he would have spent only at that point less than 3 months in jail for violating terms of probation for crime of violence. But why on earth would he be let off of probation early? That to me is just absolutely astounding. And again, this is allowed. Sheriff Shane Ferrari says yet another example of the failures of the criminal justice system in New Mexico. And again, where are Democrats focusing their time? Lawful gun owners, firearms dealers, and the most popular rifle in the country. Commonly owned magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds. That's what they're focused on. They're not focused on ensuring that violent criminals cannot prey on the innocent, including an 11-month-old child. It's sickening. It's absolutely sickening. All right. On to today's armed citizen story. Kentucky, Limestone County, where a man was shot while attempting headline says a robbery. It sounds to me like this may have been more of a home invasion. And there are some interesting quirks here. This was last Wednesday, around midnight. Deputies responded to reports of a home invasion with shots fired. When they got there, they learned that the suspect had fled after he was shot by the homeowner. Criminal Investigation Division responded, started an investigation to process the scene. While they're on the way there, there were reports of a person suffering from a gunshot wound who was at a local hospital. Investigators show up to the hospital, do some more investigating, and they discovered that the evidence showed that a man named Tanner Stewart Phillips, 31 years old, allegedly broke into a vehicle outside of the victim's home. After the homeowner confronted him, Phillips then pointed a rifle at him and then chased the homeowner back inside the residence. Homeowner was able to obtain a firearm apparently inside the home and then fired at Phillips in response, struck him multiple times, and then Phillips fled the scene. So what's kind of weird about this is that according to ABC 3340 in Kentucky, the investigation revealed that Phillips wore a bulletproof vest, a ski mask, and carried both a rifle and a pistol while attempting to rob the victim. Now, again, this guy started out by breaking into a vehicle outside of the residence. There's no indication at this point that Phillips knew the victim here. No indication that he didn't either. Police haven't said whether or not there was a prior relationship. But, you know, typically when someone's breaking into a car or even a home, they're not wearing a ballistic vest. Ski mask, sure. I would say it's odd for them to carry both a rifle and a pistol. One or the other. And again, I mean, pistols are used far more often in violent crimes than rifles of any kind. So this is, there are some oddities to this case. Limestone County Sheriff Joshua McLaughlin said, when you steal from hardworking people and threaten them with deadly weapons, you put yourself at risk of serious injury or death. He said, I'm thankful that no lives were lost. Proud of our team for following the evidence and making an arrest. Right now, Phillips has been charged with unlawful breaking and entering a vehicle, burglary in the first degree, robbery in the first degree. I don't know why he wouldn't be charged with home invasion since he chased the guy into the home, but that's what he's facing right now. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed again. We're not talking about a plea deal where all of a sudden Mr. Phillips pleads guilty to unlawful breaking and entering a vehicle and all the other charges are dropped. But we'll see what happens there in Limestone County, Kentucky. And we'll also see if we do get any more details about some of the strangeness of this particular incident. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. A fire chief in Houston who was in the right place and at the right time and willing and able to save a woman and her dog from a burning home. This happened early Monday morning, just a couple of hours before I started recording this broadcast. Deputy Chief Douglas Harrison said a chief from District 19 was driving in the area where this house fire. He saw smoke and fire at a four-unit building in northeast Houston. Unclear whether or not he was actually on duty at the time or not, but he immediately alerted the department's dispatch center to call a box alarm for a working fire. First engine showed up about 4 minutes later, and crews started searching the units to ensure that residents had evacuated. Firefighters did find a woman inside one of the apartments. They were able to pull her out. She suffered an extensive smoke inhalation. Firefighters also assisted a dog that was found at the property. They used a pet oxygen mask, and the dog appeared to be recovering. There was one resident who was initially reported to be unaccounted for. He has since been located safe and sound, but structure collapsed. The structure did collapse while the fire was being put out. So there is a potential that there are more individuals there. According to KHOU, crews plan to continue a, quote, slow, methodical sweep once the smoke conditions improve. Witness reported seeing two men at the scene arguing, with one accusing the other of setting the fire. A fire official said that the arson investigators are on the scene. Cause remains under investigation. All four units lived in at the time of the fire. And again, were it not for that chief from District 19 being in the area to see the smoke and the flames and to call it in, we don't know that that woman would have made it out of the building before it collapsed. So we don't know the name of this district fire chief, but in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We thank you for your very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. So as I mentioned, House Committee in New Mexico this afternoon holding a hearing on SB 17. If it clears that House Committee, it heads to the House floor. We are also keeping our eyes on all of the gun control bills that are still alive in Virginia. I saw some reports over the weekend that the 11% excise tax had been defeated. I don't think that's the case. One bill kind of got rolled into another. So I think the one to watch right now is, I think it's House Bill 919. And it was actually passed out of committee. It was read on the House floor for the first time on Friday. So I wish that I could say that it was dead for the session. I don't think that that's the case. As far as I'm aware, as of, you know, mid-morning on Monday, the only two gun control bills that are officially done and dead for the session are the $500 tax on suppressors and the bill that would have allowed localities to ban recreational shooting on any parcel of land less than 5 acres. Those bills have been passed over for the year, but the permit to purchase, the firearm reciprocity bills, the assault firearm and large capacity magazine bills, those bills expanding red flag laws, bills expanding ban on open carry of firearms. Everything else is still on the table as of right now. So if you are a Virginia gun owner, please be aware of that. Make sure you're following Virginia Citizen Defense League, Virginia Shooting Sports Association, NRA ILA, GOA. And tomorrow, the legislative session kicks off in Minnesota. Governor Tim Walz is still pushing for a ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. You know, he tried to get that done during a special session last fall when it became clear that the votes weren't there. Governor Walz, even though he said, we're having a special session one way or the other, backed down. And he didn't hold a special session. But he is going to be twisting arms. He's going to be doing everything he can to try to get a gun ban bill to his desk this session. We'll be talking this week with the folks from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus about that, hopefully tomorrow, but it might be later on in the week. But regardless, no matter where you live right now, chances are there's a good bill worth supporting. There's a bad bill that needs to be defeated. Please pay attention to what's going on in your state capital, whether it's through the national gun groups, whether it's through the state level groups where you live. But make sure that you are involved. Make sure that your lawmakers are hearing from you right now, because the gun control lobby is acting very aggressively around the country right now. And hopefully we can play offense. But right now I know we're playing defense in a lot of states. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. And thank you again for being a part of the program today. Do check out BearingArms.com throughout the day, keeping up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including some of the stories I just mentioned. We will see you back here tomorrow for the 2A Tuesday edition of the program. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.